Thanks for joining us, Jade. Everybody, this is another edition of the Omaha Bar Association Bar Talk Chat. I'm Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association, and I'm here today with Jay Jackson of QTAC Rock to talk about his new book, just released, Decent Discourse. I should probably say the whole name, right? Decent Discourse, Saving Your Country by Loving Your Wrong, neighbor.
Yeah.
And before we get into it, I usually ask questions about upbringing, background, things like that. Can you tell us a bit about your story and how you came to be an attorney here?
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. And thanks for doing this. First off, I grew up in South Florida, and so left when I was 16. About the only thing I have left is my sad Miami Dolphins fandom, but made my way to Indiana for college and then over to George Mason in Arlington, Virginia for law school. And actually met my wife, had our first son, and joined the military after that. So for the 14 years until 2020, we sort of traveled the world as a military family, moved every couple of years, bounced around, never in Omaha. But we frankly just had enough by 2020. I had missed too many bad times. We're looking for some stability and community, and I was lucky enough to score a job here in Omaha and settle down in the public finance department here at QTAC.
Nice. So your time in the military must have really been an important experience, molding your outlook and everything on life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was awesome. It was, super meaningful work. I woke up every day, pinching myself. I loved what I was able to do. Most of the sacrifices for military families are made by the rest of the family, that doesn't get to experience that quite so much. And so it was the right time for us, but absolutely a rewarding time and wouldn't change it for the world.
And so let's talk a little bit about just the theory behind your book. What, in a nutshell, what is it about? Would you tell somebody?
Yeah, well, I guess to continue the military conversation, I sort of got out of the military and was still looking for ways to serve and be engaged in civics. And a lot of it was just looking around and being frustrated, I think, at the political climate and the way that our political discourse was headed. And so I sat down one March Saturday morning. I don't know where my family was that I had, the bandwidth to do that in quiet and start putting pen to paper. And that's sort of how we ended up with this book.
Wow. I always like to kind of get into that process of writing the book. How long did it take you?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm not a journaler. As an attorney, we write enough and we read enough. I don't think I've ever written anything that wasn't required of me by work or school in my life. But journaling, I do know, is a good way to process and to get your thoughts out. So that's the reason that I sat down, not intending to write a book, which requires learning a new industry, actually writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting a book, and starting a small business, that comes along with that. I would say, I stay busy with work and family obligations as well. So it was a good 18 months, I think, from start to finish. Let me do the math on that. Yeah, I think that's about right. Year and a half through everything. Great editors, lots of friends and family. My wife kicking me out of the house to go, just do nothing but write in a hotel.
Yeah.
And then the book is full of, I'm not a sociologist or a political scientist, so everything smart I say in the book is stolen from somebody else. And I think, the job that I do as a lawyer is to sort of organize the case and present it and make the argument that, decent discourse is the way to incrementally fix our country up.
And when you're in the military, there's this, you can have a different opinion than, your officer next to you, but you get the job done.
Yeah.
You're there for a higher purpose. You're serving your country. You're doing the work that needs to be done. And you can disagree about things, but you still have to go ahead and do the work.
Yeah.
And that in some ways is instructive to us, isn't it? I mean, yes, we can disagree, but we still need to sort of move ahead as a country,
yeah,
as people.
Yeah, I think we've lost sight in many ways the fact that we all have a common mission, regardless of sort of your political background and where you come from. We all want to prosperity, safety, and security for our families. We want to be enjoy the freedoms that we have here in this country. We've got lots of different ways of how to go about that, but it's certainly something I wanted to focus on in the book, is all that we do have in common, the common mission that we're on as Americans.
And I mean, that's kind of founding principle is we have freedom of belief, and it's not that we're all believing the same thing necessarily, but we can live together as people who have different beliefs and support those different beliefs as long as it's not hurting anybody, right?
Yeah.
And where do we get off the rails, do you think, looking back?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things this book is, and that I am, is sort of obnoxiously optimistic. I want to try to provide some historical perspective that things have always been pretty nuts in our country. We were calling, Jefferson was calling John Adams, a hermaphrodite. And the first time that George Washington wasn't our president. And we've gone through slavery and a civil war. And, in the 1970s, there were five bombings every day from domestic terrorists from 71 to 72. And so to realize, hey, we have had lots of problems. We have been off the rails a number of times, and we've managed to get ourselves back on. To your point, I think, and President Obama used the term turbocharging, right? Social media, I think, turbocharges. A lot of what we're doing on, we weren't retweeting Jefferson's comment that Adams is a hermaphrodite like we do now. And so that makes it difficult. The fact that we can exist in communities and in media ecosystems where we receive exactly the facts we want, exactly the analysis that we want, and we don't have to interact with the people in our tribe, in our village, in our town, in our community, certainly makes it a unique challenge at this point in history.
I can order my my groceries, have them delivered to me, right? I can do my work from home. I don't necessarily need to leave the house very much anymore.
Yeah.
Interact with other people, and so much of that has gone online or what have you. And if you're not just looking at somebody face to face, eye to eye, you don't humanize them. You don't see them in all the person that they are. You maybe some way just look at this one idea that they have or belief that they have and judge them as an entire person based on that.
Yeah, I agree. You've got a caricature, of something, of, the other side, the other guy or gal, and whatever their, whatever their thing is, you've got a caricature of it and you fit it into that instead of getting to know somebody first. And then tacking on to, hey, I know somebody who I know is smart, loving, devoted, and yet has this opinion that I would generally think is crazy. It allows you, gives you a context and a foundation to understand why they might think differently than you do, right?
And what are some prescriptions that you have for somebody trying to break out of their world where they are on? They're on social media looking at the things that confirm their beliefs or that the other side's wrong, whatever the other side may be. They're watching, 24-hour news that confirms what they believe. They're only talking to people who essentially share their beliefs. What's a prescription to hopefully have them have a wider group of people that they speak with and a wider understanding of the people of this country?
Yeah. To stop doing that, to stop doing those things, right?
Turn off the TV.
Right. There are little individual problems that you identify there, and there is a solution for each of them. And acknowledging first that it's hard work. It can be emotionally exhausting, and not asking the people to be best friends with somebody whose views they find repugnant, or to be in a situation that is abusive. But to recognize, to view other people's views in the most charitable way, and to, read sort of your own favored news with the same level of scrutiny that you would look at the other side's, most favorable news. And so I think there's a solution to each of those. Some of them are practical. Some of them are, in the book, I say, hey, just go find somebody who thinks something different than you do and go have coffee with them. Mm-hmm. Even frankly, just, you know, being, you know, developing deeper friendships with the people who have the same values that you do. I think there's pretty amazing research that shows how lonely people, friendless people, are more radicalized and more polarized than the rest of us. Has zero friends. Wow. And so, and the difference, I mean, the trend is also terrible. The number of people who have either zero friends, or even, you know, there used to be, and, you know, you sort of know these people, right? The people that have, you know, 30 friends, you know, and they're just these, you know, crazy extroverts. Those people are also on the decline. And so absolutely, I think it's important to say before we say, you know, Hey, conservative, you know, go make friends with a liberal. It might just be, hey, conservative, make friends with anybody. Hey, liberal person, go be friends with anybody. Yeah. You know, have somebody to connect with and to talk to.
Yeah.
That's honest with you about, you know, where you are. Yeah.
In today's society.
Yeah, it's getting hard, particularly since everybody believes that their truth meter is, you know, working just fine and they don't need this help. Whether they are, you know, consuming sort of the MSNBC or Fox News filter, they're sure that they've got everything they need to come to the correct conclusion. I think it's hard. Number one, I think that lawyers, at least in theory, we should be good at this.
Right.
You know, we should be good at getting the facts from our side of the case and being able to view them from the other side, you know, or viewing the other, you know, and think about, hey, how could this be wrong? How is this not Loctite? And so for me, you know, I try to consume both sides. Twitter's great because I can pick people from, you know, all walks of life. But it's also easy to just sort of to do that. There's a second step to that, which is, I think, following, you know, understanding sources that are, you know, reliable and have a wide variety of views, but also the way that we ingest them. Mm-hmm. I think ingesting them in a way that is, you know, sort of with healthy skepticism, and not just a sort of nut job, and to be like, well, let me go see, you know, what they're saying over it, you know, this, and
right.
Rachel Maddow thinks this, and, you know, Tucker thinks this, and I knew that they were, you know, I find myself because I say, hey, I'm going to go see what, you know, somebody who I completely disagree with is saying. And then I, you know, my first thought, my fast brain says, I knew it. What an idiot that guy is. Instead of saying, okay, how did he get there? Again, you know, and I said it was hard. Outrage is monetized. You know, reaffirming what your viewers or your listeners already believe is what keeps them coming back and keeps you as the highest rated cable network, or, you know, the show with the greatest advertising revenue.
Yeah, it's so we need that filter. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything that's being said is wrong. We have to understand bias. We have to understand how that seeps into, you know, cherry picking facts necessarily, or just a slant on how they're saying the story is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, I go through confirmation bias in depth, and talking about how law enforcement tackles confirmation bias, how military intelligence professionals tackle confirmation bias. But absolutely, I mean, there's a powerful momentum in finding information that affirms what we want to see, and so yeah, it takes a lot of work to fight back against that.
you know, one thing that's really changed the country from my perspective, and this is me not pontificating, but me kind of theorizing here, is the decline in religion as a cornerstone of the belief system of many people in the country, and how that would bring together a community, right?
Yeah.
And how, what other viewpoint is there? I mean, country as a place for everybody, as a community that's worth having at the best level, seems to me to kind of sort of fit in the realm of a belief beyond our own that, you know, that we can do better, that that we can support one another. We kind of need to think about maybe morals and values still being there,
yeah,
just kind of defined in a different way for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really interesting point. You know, and I can't remember which book, but or maybe one of the Ben Sasse Atlantic articles. Atlantic articles are almost like books for me. Where, you know, he goes through the loss of sort of community things, not only the church but the Little League, you know, the school board, sort of all of the ways that we're connected to each other. Where if you brought, you know, your belief that, hey guys, I'm pretty sure the earth is flat, to one of those fora, you would get laughed out, and you would realize, right, it would be immediately tested among people. And we'll say there's some not good things, you know, built into that. I mean, you know, if you'd have brought to your local community in, you know, 1960 Montgomery, Alabama, that interracial marriages, that also would have happened. And so, you know, I don't want to say that's the best thing in the world. There's great stuff. The ability for us to connect on the internet with, you know, like-minded people and to generate momentum to defeat sort of injustice is fantastic. Mm-hmm. However, right, there's the flat earth guy who can go find his flat earth forum and be absolutely convinced that that's the way. The other thing, I guess, going back to your note about religion, I think we're just as religious as we were before. We're just substituting something else, right?
Right.
For many of us, right, you know, politics is the religion, right? The thing that makes you, you know, storm into the Capitol with the full belief that you are on a just and righteous, right, 1776 mission. I mean, it takes a religious-like fervor, I think,
right,
to do that. So... yeah,
that is a true believer faith, more than anything else, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give some examples, some sort of profiles and courage, so to speak, from the book and from your experiences that are the type of people that have shown,
yeah,
you know, to have good discourse across belief systems? I always think back to Ronald Reagan, and you know, I'll, you know, you can disagree with me, but we can be cordial, and you know, that's your belief and this is my,
yeah,
belief, but we can move on, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the end all be all. I always think about that. I know that Tip O'Neill and he had a great relationship because they understood,
yeah,
we don't believe the same thing, but we can still work together. But are there some profiles of courage in here, or just ones that you think are good examples of people in the political spectrum or in the world that that we should take a look at and try to emulate?
Yeah, thanks. I think, you know, the first thing is recognize that we're all imperfect and we all have our moments. I mean, I can't tell you the number of snarky tweets that I miss out on because I'm a decent discourse guy. I really have to, you know, throttle back. But, you know, I've got a part that I talk about. I encourage folks to be radically moderate. So, I mean, you know, radical in the sense that we are being counterculturally generous and charitable in the way that we interact with each other. And sort of my three examples that I use there are Elliot Richardson, who was Nixon's Attorney General, who resigned rather than fire Archibald Cox, the Watergate Special Prosecutor. I'm not going in chronological order here, but Margaret Chase Smith, she's a freshman senator in 1950. She gives her Declaration of Conscience speech on the floor of the Senate against McCarthyism. And then John McCain, right, who is, you know, in the throes of the election against Barack Obama, and is in a very friendly town hall where people are helping him by noting that you know, Obama is Arab or from Kenya or whatever. And he says no. He's just, you know, a decent family man with whom I happen to have fundamental disagreements. And, you know, at one point takes the microphone back from the lady as she is only beginning to launch into her tirade. So people who really care about the country, who put the country before themselves. And so those are three, you know, quick examples. And probably, you know, we have so many examples of people that we see every day, people who in, you know, they work in some vocation that's dedicated to helping people. They work in a, you know, a nursing home, or they're an occupational therapist, or, you know, you've got a relative or a spouse or a friend that takes care of an elderly parent or grandparent. I think, you know, hopefully, you know, your listeners can think of that person in their own life, you know, that provides inspiration for decency.
How long has the book been out, by the way?
May 25th.
Okay. And I did go on Amazon, couldn't find a bad review. I wanted to bring a bad review and say, you know, reply to this, but nobody was giving a bad review there. How has the feedback been? What have people been saying? And has there been anything that surprised you when you've had conversations with people about it?
Yeah. I'll start positive. You know, which is my favorite reviews, my favorite, you know, emails that I get from folks are, hey, I never read, but I loved this book and was able to finish it. And so, you know, I wanted it to be accessible. I know there are a couple of high school students that are reading it now.
Nice.
I'm super excited about that.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be accessible. This isn't, it's not written for, you know, a PhD in sociology who's examining, you know, it's written for somebody who's struggling with their, you know, their MAGA aunt or their, you know, whatever. And is seeing relationships break down because of you know, political discourse, number one. So I love that. And number two, I wrote it, again, sort of optimistic and be encouraged. If you go look at the books about political discourse, they're basically prepping you for the civil war that is inevitable. And I wanted to try to provide something that says, hey, actually, you know, I don't know that we have to go that way.
Yeah.
You're not crazy that it looks really bad. You've got some agency in your day-to-day personal interactions. And I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. You mentioned negative reviews, and I do want to, people have been very generous so far. But I got a great email this past weekend from a guy who said, hey, actually stopped reading your book because it felt like you were being biased. But you know, particularly January 6th.
I've been trying to find bias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to write it down the middle.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I've got my own thoughts about things.
Yeah.
70% of Republicans think that January 6th in particular, or I shouldn't say that, but that the 2020 election was stolen.
Right.
And so, you know, comments about January 6th, comments about the election, I think, tend to rub people a certain way. And so it was super gracious and super constructive. He said, hey, I think that, you know, this, your left-leaning bias is, I'm a registered Republican, by the way, but right, your left-leaning bias is coming out in this book. And I don't think that, you know, that was very fair. Here's another book that I thought was better and an article I think you should read. And I wrote him back and, you know, honestly thought about it, tried to digest it, wrote the guy back and said, hey, yeah, I'm sure all my biases are baked into this book. I'm never going to know about them if, you know, 5-star reviews don't tell me anything about that. Thanks so much for your email.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we sort of left it there. So, I mean, I think those are the kinds of interactions we need more of. And not so much, you know, me. I mean, it would be pretty lame if I, you know, told him he was an idiot or something in the email after writing this book. But for that guy to reach out, you know, to an author of a book and say, hey, I feel this coming through in a way that I think is, you know, is wrong. And here's how I see it. And here's something else. Like, I was super grateful for that kind of feedback.
Well, that graciousness is pretty telling and important, right? You know, somebody's coming with a critique, you can take it as a criticism, as, you know, as something that you need to fight against or defend yourself.
Yeah.
Or you can try to take everything that you can out of it as a learning experience and thank them for the energy to write and to communicate that. You're not necessarily going to change their mind. They're not going to make you rewrite the book, but you know, understanding other people's perspectives is what it's all about, right?
Yeah. And so, right, one of five parts in the book is about, you know, sort of a victimhood culture that I feel like we live in, where we're super thin-skinned. We sort of lost the value, lost that we value having thick skin, sort of as a, you know, a core principle in our country. I think now that review was easy to respect, easy to understand. That feedback. I heard something on a podcast a couple weeks ago. I talk about my faith. I'm a Christian. I talk about my faith in the book a bit. There's a pastor named John Piper. He's a pretty famous guy. He's a part of a big evangelical church in New York, which, you know, automatically is sort of, you know, intriguing and interesting. Yeah. But he's also a prolific writer. You know, like any prolific writer, he gets lots of feedback. Much of it, you know, great and constructive, and, you know, I'm sure some of it on the fringes, quite crazy. And he says that he looks for, in every sort of, you know, note full of, you know, rancor, and he says, hey, what nugget of truth is there in this that I can take in and make better? And so that's something that I think, you know, is, had I known about that before I wrote the book, I would have maybe included that anecdote in there. But I think that's exactly how we have to approach interactions like that.
You talked a bit about the thin skin, and I certainly agree that we seem to be thinner skin than we used to be, right? Turn the other cheek doesn't seem to be the thing anymore. It's you know, it's delete this person from your Facebook friends.
Yeah.
It's cancel. And you know, we could have a long discussion about cancel culture and things that should be canceled and things that should be canceled.
Sure.
That are. But this idea of, can somebody apologize? Can we apologize and be forgiven and move on, or can we accept apologies? Right, right now, it seems to be a new world that didn't necessarily exist when we were growing up. You know, is an apology real, or is it contrived because they don't want to be canceled, or they, you know, that whole idea of accepting somebody's apology seems like outrageous all of a sudden, which is crazy, you know.
Yeah.
Being offended, but then moving on, or being offended and accepting somebody's apology that they didn't mean what they said.
Yeah.
Stepping back from the brink there, that. what happened with all that? I don't really have a question here. I guess I'm just talking.
No, we knew you're right. We can pivot to parenting for a second, because
I can tell
you how we apologize in the Jackson house.
Yeah.
And what it is, right? It's not sorry, you know, for doing that, right? We say, you know, you call out what you did, it was wrong, and you acknowledge how it hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, hey Dave, you know, I'm sorry I said that bad thing about you. It was short-sighted. I didn't think it through, and I can see how that, you know, hurt. I mean, there aren't a lot of apologies like that, I think, you know, posted to Instagram, you know, in the notebook function that look like that. But yeah, we're also not great at accepting apologies, to your point. I gave a speech a couple weeks ago to a group and referenced the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, which is the church that Dylann Roof went into in the summer of 2015 or 2017, and killed, you know, nine of the parishioners that had invited him in for Bible study. He said, they were almost so nice to me. They were almost so nice to me. I almost didn't go through with it. Was what he said after the fact. And so 2 days after this, family members are murdered by a white supremacist. Several of them lined up to say, hey, we forgive you. One of the women at a sentencing hearing a few months later said, hey, if you are ever in jail and by the way, Dylann Roof, no remorse over any of this. Mm-hmm. They didn't wait for, you know, him to show remorse,
right,
to forgive him. Because forgiveness, I think, ultimately, right, is about us, usually, not the other person. The woman said, hey, if you If you ever want me to come pray with you in prison, I'll do that. And I think about that somewhat regularly. I mean, I don't know how, you know, not daily, but the fact that, hey, somebody could murder the people that I love most, and I could forgive them. And so, you know, so when you call me an idiot on Facebook, it's easy, you know, if you have, I didn't seen that yet, but you know, it's easy to think back and to get some perspective of these people who did that. I, you know, we talk about everyday heroes, sort of profiles and courage. Those are folks I look to of, you know, if they can do that, then I can do, you know, just about anything that, you know, offends me on the internet, I can get over.
It's empowering to forgive, I think, in some ways, right? I mean, it to not be consumed by it. There are unforgivable things. Maybe there aren't, but when you can offer grace and forgiveness, that hatred fire doesn't consume you necessarily as much, and you can be you can do more than just focus on that.
Yeah. And we each have to be our own arbiter of how far is too far. And you know, the line between you know, inconvenience and hurt and, you know, injustice and abuse, and that's different. Everybody has a different threshold for what that is based on their background. I think the thing that I urge people to do in the book is just be slow to come to that conclusion, and to you know, offer grace and to view the other person most charitably and give them the opportunity, I think, to earn that trust back.
So we're here at the Omaha Bar Association. You are an attorney. I think that there's a lot that attorneys can use in their day-to-day practice, not necessarily just talking about politics around the office or anything like that. And I like to say, you can talk politics, but you can also talk policy, which I love to talk more than politics. The game of, you know, how to get to 51, I'm not as interested in as, is this good policy that helps our country move forward? Yeah. So I always try to tell people, you know, you're talking about elected officials. You call them politicians, they're going to act like it. You call them elected officials, hopefully they act a little bit more like your representative. But as attorneys, you know, there's some of this that can really apply to how we interact with one another. I know that it can get inflammatory when you're in the throes of a case and, you know, you're going nose-to-nose with the other side. But doesn't always mean that it's the most effective way to lawyer and get what you want, right?
Yeah. There are a couple stories in the book that are from my own professional background. In the first case, I extrapolated, you know, out of sort of my professional life to the whole world. And that's an old Air Force chief of staff that would say, hey, you know, in order to, that every airman has a story was the gist of it. And to know somebody's story before you judge them, right? It's the old just, you know, walk a mile in their shoes.
Right.
And so, yeah, when opposing counsel seems especially short or difficult that day, or, you know, or your partner or your, you know, your paralegal or, you know, whoever it is, to take the time to step back and, you know, and understand why they're that way. The other one, you know, comes from my last boss at Joint Special Operations Command, where two people were bickering, and both thought they were right and were trying to convince the other one that they were right. And she, you know, elbowed me, I can't remember, in a meeting or on email, wherever it was. And she said, "You see this? They're so worried about being right that they've forgotten how to be effective." And so, you know, that's what I see of, you know, people who are, you know, chasing important policy issues. They want to prove that their policy is the right policy instead of being effective, which is, you know, winning people over to their side and building relationships in a way that, you know, winsomely convinces people of the efficacy of whatever it is they want.
That bears repeating. It's better to be effective than right. And a lot of times people want to be right more than they want to be effective. And in lawyering, that we certainly see that a lot of times that, gosh, you know, at the end of the day, how are we going to settle this case or get it to the best outcome for a client? That's not necessarily what, you know, should be right under the law. Maybe this has not been decided this way by the courts before, but we know that if we present this the right way, they're going to actually understand that you know, this should be expected, all that. And it right now, it certainly seems this summer, with some big decisions coming down from the Supreme Court, that the legal profession and the role of courts and laws has certainly come to the center of our country, of our republic. So everyone's looking at us now, you know, lawyers out there, how are you responding to this? What are you doing to right a wrong, or to move forward this country?
Right? Yeah. You know, and I just want to make the point and follow up with that. You know, the book is not about being a centrist or having moderate politics. I think it's important to say you can feel really strongly about these, you know, Supreme Court decisions or what's going on in your community, and think that you are in fact right about it. I think the book is about how we do it. It's more about how we do politics than any particular policy position.
I like that a lot, because I think that, you know, I talked about this with somebody, and I think that was sort of their takeaway from reading the cover and maybe skimming the first couple pages was, well, you know, you're telling me I have to be a centrist and I, you know, I have to lessen my belief level from an extreme to the center. And that our country has been full of people who believe things extreme for our entire existence before our country was a country, when it was still a colony. I mean, we had that extreme belief. So we've always kind of been a bit crazier than the rest of the world with our strong beliefs on things, right? It's sort of what makes us.
Yeah, I mean, we started off, you know, throwing tea into the harbor. You know, actually, I had a great conversation recently with somebody gave me the quiz throughout history of, was it decent discourse to throw the tea into the harbor? Was it decent discourse? It was a wonderful conversation. But, you know, there's a great, this was in just like an op-ed, I think, in the Washington Post a couple years ago. Somebody described Joe Manchin as, you know, if one side said, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 and the other said 2 + 2 = 8, Manchin would say 2 + 2 = 6, and thinking anything differently divides the country. I thought that was a great, you know, so, you know, to read this book, you do not have to think that 2 + 2 = 6, you know, regardless of whether or not, you know, what your thoughts are on Joe Manchin. I thought that was a funny way of describing a centrist.
growing up in your household and in your community, did you have, you know, liberal and conservative friends? Did you have all these different viewpoints going on? I think you mentioned some of this in the book. You
know? Yeah, a little bit. And so my background was not one that was terribly political at all, really, and to include my military career, just because we're focused on it. I'm a nonpartisan instrument of the executive branch, and my job is to put my head down and consistent with our values and the rule of law and do what we can for our country. So it really was when I got out and got engaged politically. A couple things I think growing up that still I think provide some of the foundation for the book are, you know, like a lot of 1980s kids, I was a latchkey kid of two divorced parents with two very different parenting styles. And so I talk in the book about being able to say, okay, mom loves me, dad loves me. Dad's got a lot of legal issues and money issues and, you know, lady issues. Mom is pretty stable and doesn't have those same things, but I know they both still love me. I know they're both mom and dad, and so to be able to appreciate both of them in different ways, I think, was an important part of that. And then the other piece was I lived in a super diverse community in South Florida, but I was in a, you know, like a magnet program with all the suburban white kids. But I also loved football and played football and ended up playing football at in college a little bit. And, you know, our football team was, you know, 3/4 black dudes, and, you know, Jamaican guys and Hispanic guys. And they had problems that I didn't have in the magnet program. I had a buddy shoot himself at school. You know, there were substance abuse problems that I didn't know about and didn't see. I would go to their homes and see how their homes were different from my home. And so I lived in, you know, two communities, and I knew that, you know, my magnet school buddies were fantastic. And Derek drove his, you know, 5-liter Mustang, and we would go get, you know, frozen yogurt. You know, I'm trying to think of the most stereotypical, like, white suburban thing I can think of. And I could go hang out with Nate in his Cadillac and go to his house where we had, you know, City Punch, which is tap water. And love Nate and love Derek and, you know, fully exist in those communities. It's the other thing, I think, just to carry that forward, it's a long-winded answer, but to carry that forward into where we are now, we're all on teams, and I have to decide, am I on Derek's team or Nate's team? And, you know, once I've established what team I'm on, I have to believe that everything on the other side is, you know, ridiculous, crazy, uninformed, or idiotic, and so.
It's that whole zero-sum mentality versus actually we don't have to, you know, push down somebody to build somebody else up.
Yeah. Right?
And you can understand that these people, you know, look at the world in different ways. You can exist in both those worlds. You don't have to necessarily only exist in one or only believe one is the right way or is the way that you want to live your life. It's pushing into that gray, right? You know, the black and white is easy. It's tough to live in the gray.
Yeah. And you get security in the community of being completely in the black or completely in the white. Right. I mean, there is, you know, it feels good to, you know, put on the uniform and know that somebody has your back, and it's uncomfortable to say, I usually agree with you guys.
Right.
But I think we've got this one wrong.
Right.
It's hard.
The discomfort of decent discourse.
That's right.
Another D. I'm all about alliteration.
That's excellent.
So I have more questions, but we've covered most everything. Is there anything that you wanted to chat about the book, about the, you know, the attorneys in the bar, anything else? I love the book. I give it 5 stars, 6 if I could. I got it at Bookworm, local bookstore here, but I know it's on Amazon and everything like that. Anything that I didn't hit on, any questions that I should ask that you were ready to answer?
No, I don't think so. I think you've been pretty comprehensive. I hope that people that read it leave encouraged, you know, that they sit it down and they're ready to, you know, to sort of put it to use, to, you know, that they don't, it doesn't end with reading it, that it is, hey, I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to call my dad, you know, and ask him to, you know, get away from Facebook and whatever his Facebook thing is. I'm going to call him and see how he's doing, or, you know, I'm going to call the sister that I haven't talked to since the, you know, 2016 election. I hope that it's an encouragement to folks, and that it does just crack the door open a little bit, maybe repair some relationships, and get people, you know, excited about the direction of our country, and maybe that it's not quite as terrible as it sometimes seems.
The end of days is not so near for our country. Yeah. I like that idea that it's, you read the book, but there's homework, there's, you know, prescriptions out of that it's going to be more than just reading the book. If you're engaged in the book, you're pushing them to go do more. And that's good. You know, this isn't confirming anybody's beliefs necessarily as much as pushing them to expand into understanding other people better, which I love.
Thanks.
And the whole idea, you know, the Bar Association is, I like to say, you know, let's not be horrible people to each other. Let's understand the opposing counsel. Let's understand each other. So we pick up the phone instead of sending that nasty gram email or demand letter. You know, this fits with, I think, the ethos, the philosophy of what the Bar Association is about, is understanding other people better, and becoming a cohesive community out of it. So I appreciate your time today. I appreciate the 18 months you spent on the book. I know that you're doing some book tour stuff around town, so people can go to the website.
DecentDiscourse.com. DecentDiscourse.com. That's right. Yeah.
You got it.
I'm on Goodreads and Amazon. My author pages are there too. So.
Are you doing an audiobook version?
Maybe. I would love to. Yeah. You know, being a lawyer, most of my, you know, my reading is through audiobook now. So I would love to do that. That's next, but not yet.
Well, I appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to talking down the way. Is there another book in the works?
No, there's not.
This is the one for now, and we're not looking at round two yet. Okay.
Yeah. Not yet. It's funny, you know, consistent though with some of what I was saying, I've had several parents say, hey, when are you going to write this for teenagers? And so that is maybe that's the next step.
One thing I really enjoy, and I've seen it a couple times, but you did it really well, is this: you write something and maybe in my mind it like triggers like a kind of a side thought, and you go right at it with a parenthesis of like kind of saying like, I get where your brain just went down a rabbit hole, and you do that in the moment. You don't like drop a footnote and then I'm like searching. I like the use of parenthetical phrases to really keep the person from going off the rails, which my ADD brain of social media and everything like now leads me to be like, wait, what? And then you're like, I know, I got you. I know where you're at.
Yeah.
And you know, when, if you you're writing the teenager version of this, I think that's super effective. And I think this would be great, you know, book for middle school, for high schoolers, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
More of this. So I'll keep pushing that. I'll keep coming back and pushing on that. But thanks for the time, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, appreciate it, Dave. Thank you.